I'll just say a little bit of an introduction about sort of why I chose this theme. I think actually it was going through a time where, I don't know if you ever get this, but you sort of feel a bit like, here's my Dharma practice. And what's the point? Like, what am I actually doing? And I often feel like that. I find myself having this small existential crisis of sitting in my retreat centre in mid Wales, having been practicing for over half my life. And sort of thinking, well, here I am in the Brecon Beacons, in this room, in this house. But what am I actually doing? And what's this all about? And also, I'm very much involved in the ordination process. And, you know, we have these conversations about the future of the ordination process and how to help people get ordained and all this sort of stuff. And I kind of think, but why would you do that? Do you know what I mean? You sort of step back from your life and you think, what is this, you know? And what is actually fundamentally my practice? You know, what makes me different from being a Buddhist and not being a Buddhist? And what makes my life a Dharma life and not just any life, you know? So I was having one of those things where I sit there and take a look at my life and wonder what am I doing with it. And actually what I thought, I sort of kind of came down to what is my kind of daily practice, because it's not just about meditation, it's about what you're doing all the time. What is my Buddhist practice moment by moment? And that got me to think a little bit more about effort. And also looking at my own personality, I don't know if this resonates with other people, but I can often go through sort of cycles of quite a lot of inspiration and energy and galvanization towards the spiritual life. And then I suddenly go a bit flat and think, what is this all about? And then feel like actually I don't really want to make much effort, and suddenly I want to just want to watch movies, basically, and eat. So, actually, I wrote to Panti about this many years ago and said, you know, I do experience these cycles of inspiration and despondency, sort of thinking, well, I can't do it, or, you know, sometimes it'd be quite extreme, a lot of energy to go and sort of manifest in the Dharma life, and then this kind of cycle where I just feel a bit hopeless, and like, I can't really do it, who am I anyway? So I wrote to Panti about it, and he wrote back and said, well, thank you for the letter. Do you remember the story of Sona? Who's Sona? Not our Sona, as in you all remember. I assumed he meant something out of the Polar Channel. So I went and looked it up, and I don't know if you've ever heard this story. Sona was a disciple of the Buddha, and he was a lute player, and he was really struggling practicing the Dharma, and he said to the Buddha, you know, I'm really struggling and I'm thinking about giving up. What they'd noticed as well, the Buddha had noticed when he was doing his walking meditation, he'd sort of get into these kind of fits of like, you know, I've really got to try, and he'd do all this walking meditation and then his feet started to bleed. So he'd kind of go again with these cycles of, you know, really, really intense effort, doing a lot of walking meditation and then feeling just like giving up. You know, I'm not getting anywhere, what's the point? And the Buddha said to him, well, what were you before you were a monk? And he said, I was a lute player. And he says, oh, well, tell me, how do you get the best notes from your lute? Is it when the strings are quite soft and slack? And he said, no, that's hopeless. He said, well, is it when the strings are very, very tight? And he said, no, that's hopeless too. He said, you've got to get it just right, just enough give and just enough tension. And the Buddha said, so it is with the Dharma life. So, really, that's about a kind of balanced effort, what we call balanced effort. And that's the kind of thing that we're looking for in the spiritual life. But of course, it's not always such an easy thing. I think, because thinking about those cycles of inspiration and despondency, what I found is that with effort, they're constantly circled by either restlessness or torpor, sort of that sense of, well, inspiration and despondency. And in a way, they're the near and far enemies of effort. So I just thought I'd say a little bit about those, because Bhante's also, he's done quite a lot about kind of effort and energy, Bhante, Sankaracharya. And I suppose what the near enemy is we can think we're making effort when it's that kind of willful, pushed effort that Sona was making when his feet were bleeding as he was doing his walking meditation. And it's worth unpacking what state that is. Bhante talks about it as wrong effort. He says what we're trying to do is it's important to make effort in the spiritual life, but there's such a thing as wrong effort. Has anyone got an idea of what wrong effort might look like?
Doing things because you think you have to, or
something
like that.
Yeah, doing things because you think you have to.
Just an element of force, kind of really forcing yourself to, with an unkindness.
So why would one force oneself?
So you want to look good.
Yes, you want to look good.
Achieve
something.
Pride.
Yeah, pride.
Also, because it's hard to get a balance between what's, you know, I know I want to do this,
yeah.
So I will set this target, for example, or I'll say I am going to, you know, I'll commit to this, and then what's the balance of forcing yourself on the times when you don't want to fulfill that? So
so
it's just hard.
Yeah. I know it is hard because you know sometimes we do need to push ourselves.
Right.
Yes, as you were saying. So sometimes you need to make a commitment and just do it, even if it's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I remember someone saying to me once. He said, "Oh, these Buddhists, you have to be spiritually inspired to take out the dustbin." You know, we can't waste when we're all kind of really happy to do anything. You know, sometimes it is a bit, you do have to make, you know, push yourself beyond your comfort zone. I mean, what Bhante said about this was quite interesting. He said, well, actually, what you're trying to do is you're trying to incorporate the Dharma into your existing being. So you're trying to make the Dharma something that you add on. So this is where the sort of pride and trying to look good comes in. And fundamentally, you're not actually letting yourself change. You're trying to master the Dharma. So he talks a lot about kind of mastering the Dharma, like having it as something, I am doing this, look at me. That often comes with I am doing this, is look at me, I'm doing this. And I'm gonna master this. I'm gonna have it in a particular way. And kind of push myself through something. But you're not actually allowing your being to change and absorb what you're doing in a process of change. So you're incorporating it into your existing being. You're mastering it rather than surrendering to it, rather than allowing yourself to let these practices change you and be receptive to those changes. So then Bhante asks this very interesting question. He says, why is it that the Buddha, before his enlightenment, came back to his experience as a child under the rose apple tree? So if you remember the story of the Buddha, he was in the higher dhyanas, he was in the four formless dhyanas, which, I mean, basically, most of us, if we were in the four formless dhyanas, would think we're enlightened, because you're in the sphere of neither perception nor no perception. You can stay there forever. You know, it's just a complete kind of flow of experience, intensely blissful. And you don't even need to move. There's no compulsion to do anything. There's no, you know, there's no distinguishing between this and that. You know, it's a sort of, in a way, it's a kind of non-dual experience. So he got into these states of mind with his teachers, and they'd said, well, you've reached our level, you know, take over the Sangha. And he realized it wasn't enlightenment, so he went off on his own. He refused that invitation to lead those communities of ascetics, because they were sort of wandering practitioners. He'd surpassed his teachers, He could have led those communities, but he knew it wasn't enlightenment. And what he remembered sitting under the, going to the Bodhi tree, was that he remembered this experience from childhood. Does anyone remember it? The rose apple tree. Mm-hmm. So he was sitting underneath the tree, watching the ploughing, apparently, some sort of ploughing competition. And he got into the first dhyana. So he was experiencing still thought, subtle thought, but it was free from the hindrances and very kind of relaxed and open. And it said at that point the sun stood still in the sky. You know, so it's quite a kind of profound experience. And Panti asked the question, well, why would that be important? Because he'd got into higher dhyanas with his other teachers. Actually, first dhyana is fairly elementary. So what was it that he thought was important about that experience rather than the experiences with his teachers? Does anyone know? What can you think is the difference between the experiences he had with his teachers and that experience with the rose apple tree?
I would say it arose naturally.
It arose naturally, yeah. And how did it arise? What conditions were there? Just imagine yourself.
Pleasure and relaxation.
Pleasure, yeah. Relaxation, pleasure. He was in nature. I think it's interesting that the most profound Buddha experiences the Buddha had was under trees. Well, obviously, yeah, it's a different time and they spent more time probably than we do under trees. But, yeah, he was in nature. It was a kind of natural, relaxed concentration. And Bhante says that basically he thinks the difference is that with his teachers he was willing himself into the higher dhyanas. With the rose apple tree, he thought, well, that was the more important experience because it arose naturally on the basis of pleasure and relaxation. And he said, at that point the Buddha said, why should I be afraid of pleasure, which has its roots in the spiritual life? You know, doesn't contain craving, basically. It's just that simple, natural pleasure. And Bhante said, basically, if you force your mind, you can get into higher states of concentration, but it's characterized by either rebellion or morbid hypnotic fixation. I mean, I have seen actually people in states of morbid hypnotic fixation. You can get yourself into a catatonic state. So basically, it's like, you know, you're so willed that your whole being basically is intention. Or you just get this rebellion and, you know, people do. If they push themselves too hard in the spiritual life, you know, then they just go and have a bit of a meltdown and go out drinking and clubbing and whatever. Maybe, you know, sometimes people need to do that. So I think it's coming back. When he's talking about effort, he's talking about that experience of the rose apple tree. That's what we're looking for in meditation. We're not looking to push ourselves through the hindrances. We're looking for that natural experience of pleasure and relaxation. And then, you know, the far end, the other end of that is away from that kind of forced effort, is that when maybe you get into a period of doubt and you don't make any effort at all, what's the point? That there's no point in making effort. And I think that's interesting because really what that is doubt in, it's not just doubt in yourself, because I think often we can think, well, it's really important to believe in yourself. But what are you believing in? I believe in myself. What does that mean? You know. Well, what it means in a way is that actually it's not believing in yourself. It's believing in praticca samuppada. So it's believing in conditioned arising. And I think this is really the fundamental thing. I was thinking about praticca samuppada. How is it that I actually practice this? You know, because obviously there's different ways of looking at it. 24 nidanas and... you know, so the spiral, the wheel of life and the spiral path. There's all sorts of ways you can approach it. But I was thinking, well, what is the fundamental practice that arises out of Praticca Sammapada? And I thought, well, it's effort. Actually, it's the four right efforts. Because what it's saying is, I'm not a victim in my life. These states of mind that I'm in don't just happen to me. It's not like I was born, and this is the real crux of the Dharma. I was not just born with a fixed nature. That's Atman. You know, that I am, my name is Vajratara, and I go through cycles of inspiration and despondency. And you know, and I've got a particular character. But it doesn't have to be that I'm then a victim of my own mental states. I'm not passive within that. I'm not helpless within that. Because if you feel that, you know, you just succumbed by mental states and this is yourself and there's nothing you can do about it, in a way, what that's a belief in it is Atman. It's a belief in a fixed, enduring selfhood. Whereas as the Buddha's teaching was not that things don't happen to us. It was that, so, you know, the two extreme views would be, on the one hand, my mental states just happen to me. That's who I am. I can't help it. I am this type of person, and I'm, you know, succumb to these kind of mental states. The other extreme would be to say, there's no habits in my being at all. You know, so there's no such thing as personality, and there's no such thing as patterns of mental states. But the Buddha was saying something much more subtle. He was saying, well, there is a kind of pattern of mental states that people generally tend towards, but they're not me and they're not mine, and they arise in dependence upon conditions. And when those conditions cease, those mental states cease, which is very, very profound. You know, it's very simple. It's saying, yes, you do get kind of caught in cycles, but you aren't defined by those cycles. You can break free. What a relief, you know, what a relief. What it means is, the implications of that is to make the right kind of effort at the right time and to respond to one's mind to cultivate positive mental states. What Bhante says about this I'm sure you've heard these or read these lectures of the Noble Eightfold Path, but what he says in Perfect Effort is he says something really, really interesting, which I'd forgotten about, but when I looked over it again, I realised I'd underlined it twice. It's important. Which is that he says you've got to be aesthetically active. Perfect effort means you've got to be aesthetically active. Which is quite a thing to say when you're talking about effort. What does it suggest to you, the phrase, you've got to be aesthetically active?
Just aesthetic.
Yeah, I'm responding
creative,
to that.
Creative, appreciative.
Yeah, creative.
Discernment.
Yeah, discerning. And what are you discerning?
Well, I suppose what is going to serve you best, really, but also something, you know, the difference between a higher aesthetic and something lower or coarser.
Yeah. Okay, so that's really interesting, because how do you notice the higher aesthetic or what's coarser in your experience?
Or how it has an effect on you.
I mean, I think in a way what you're then, yes, you're learning to be receptive to what's beautiful, which is, does anyone remember the Pali for beautiful?
Shubha.
So what's beautiful? Which also means sort of pure. It also means bright. There's another word as well, which is
Kalyana.
Kalyana. And what are the sort of three features of Kalyana?
True, good,
and beautiful. So it means that you're responding to what is Kalyana, what is Shubha, what is true and good and beautiful. You're responding to that, And the other side of that is your sort of almost shrinking away from what is ugly. So interestingly, the Buddha said that how you know something is the Dharma, one of the characteristics of the Dharma, is that it leads you to delight in what's shubha, what's beautiful, and to not delight in what is ugly and violent. You know, and that's one of the characteristics of the Dharma, which of course is very important because sometimes people do violence in the name of Buddhism, particularly as we've seen this week, very sadly, in Sri Lanka. You know, and in a way the Buddha was saying, you know it's not the Dharma. It's not because it's well worked out, even the precepts, it's even more basic than the precepts themselves. It's because if you're delighting in violence or ugliness or hatred, it's not the Dharma. It's an aesthetic quality, and it's a response of one's being. One's being shrinks from the ugly and opens out and responds to the beautiful. And I think that's really, in a way, that's the sort of aesthetically active part of right effort, is we've got to learn how to really trust that basic instinct. It's not new. It's not that there's, you know, it's something that's in us all. And that, in a way, that particular function of our being is the reason why we can get enlightened. Because human beings do respond to the beautiful and they shrink from the ugly. And if you can just kind of keep with that flow, then you're practicing the Dharma. And that enables you to gain enlightenment.
In a sense, we're talking about Shraddha here.
Yes.
You know, my initial response to that phrase, aesthetic action, was, yeah, well, that's Shraddha.
Yeah.
You know, it reminded me, it's really evocative of that phrase of Bhante's about Shraddha being a response of,
yes,
you could say, what is aesthetic within, yeah, us to what's,
yeah,
Kalyana or beautiful, yeah, in the universe.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, you know, that's how I make sense of what Shraddha means. It is a quality, a responsive quality that helps us to, as you explained, move towards what is good, what is beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, exactly. So then if you come back to the rose apple tree, it's not that the Siddhartha, as was the little boy, had a reason out sort of Shraddha to the three jewels or even decided at that point he was going to get enlightened. Something much more basic than that. His being was responding to beauty and openness and that kind of simple movement of the plant. And that's faith, in a way. That's the kind of really basic instinct, yes, of faith. And that, in a way, that's effort, that's what we're learning to do. Both inside ourselves, that response inside ourselves and outside ourselves as well. Which is why I think it's significant that the Buddha was in a kind of beautiful surrounding.
It struck me this morning when we were doing the precepts. I think before, I might have thought of the precepts as, oh, I've got to do this, you know, this is, yes, this is my, these are my thing, this is my thing, and hard work, follow these precepts.
Mm.
And it always in the past had puzzled me why there was sadhu in there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And this morning I thought, oh God, it's because they're amazingly beautiful.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's, yeah, because it's a celebration of what it means to be, to have, yeah, a beautiful life.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that's why it's sadhu when we act like,
yeah,
this.
Yeah.
Sadhu, it's beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And you can see such wonderful things in life, can't you? You can see such moments of kindness and openness. It's got nothing to do with whether you're in a Buddhist centre or not or anything like that. It's more like, you know, you see such goodness and your being responds. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to bring more beauty into the world. It's very interesting actually talking to people in India about vegetarianism, because that particular community traditionally ate meat because they often belonged to a caste that was given them the rights on any animal that died. So vegetarianism is associated with Brahmanism, and these very, very strict rules of purity in a ritualistic sense, because, you know, they didn't want to touch dead animals, which was about ritual purity, and, you know, so then the whole caste system is about ritual purity. And trying to shift that, and I think we all have to do this, it's not just in India, it's trying to shift from ethics, like you said, as a kind of thing where it's a bit like, these are the rules, and, yeah, I've got to do it, and about some kind of external law, and actually it being more about a response to what is, it's nothing to do with ritual purity or impurity or rules or anything else. It's basically because there is life, and you resonate with life, and why would you want to harm it?
And with deeds of loving kindness, I purify my body.
Yeah.
With open-handed generosity, I purify my body.
Yeah.
Not by not eating. So
yeah, exactly.
Things, not by doing these rituals.
Yeah, yeah.
This is how you do it.
Yeah.
Not like that.
Yeah. You're cultivating a certain state of mind. It's a state of mind.
Could I ask a question on this? This thing about beauty, about what is Shubha, responding to that, but am I right in understanding in certain places that the Buddha said that we should view things as Ashubha in a way? I know that, you know, Bhante has recently written about how we could even say that Ashubha, things being not beautiful, is almost like a mark of the way things are. So how do we kind of, because I know we all experience beauty and we respond to beauty, we grow through responding to beauty, but then at the same time there does seem to be this current in the Dharma that encourages us also to look at its opposite. How do we make sense of that?
Well, I think one of the things is the Buddha didn't say to see all things as ugly. He said the problem is, it's one of the prayasas. He says we see what is ugly as beautiful. And then he said, when you reach the liberation of the beauty, he said some people, the Buddha said this himself, because some ascetics accuse me of saying everything is ugly. He says, I'm not saying everything is ugly. What I'm saying is that when you reach the liberation of the beauty, then you know what beauty really is. So what he was encouraging you to do was, in a way, that process, which is looking at higher states of consciousness as being beautiful, and things that we can regard as beautiful, which are actually about kind of greed, hatred, and delusion as being ugly. So he was encouraging that kind of refinement of seeing what truly is beautiful and what is really ugly. You know, because we can see that it's a bit like, well, celebrity culture. You can see that as kind of beautiful, as having, or its most extreme version, sort of plastic surgery and kind of pumping stuff into your body to make your muscles bigger or whatever it is. This is where you realise, I live in a retreat in Wales. I've got no idea, this is completely alien. But, you know, so, oh, for example, you know, going to India, there's a whole association with fairness as beauty. And there's this cream called Fair and Lovely, which has got hydrogen peroxide in it, which people put on to make their skin white. We go on sunbeds, which give us cancer, to make us a bit browner. You know, so, by the way, I'm going to set fire to Fair and Lovely. I can't bear it. So if I go into hiding and the Fair and Lovely factory in India is burnt down.
We know.
So in a way, that's an association of beauty. But actually, you know, it's ugly. You're bleaching your skin, or you're going under a sunbed and giving yourself skin cancer.
Are you talking about the more refined beauty, like a beautiful painting, that we might really respond to something very refined, we respond to that beauty? Are you talking about that kind of, the kind of beauty that Bhante would encourage us to cultivate? Even that, you're saying?
No, not necessarily. I suppose I'm just questioning that there seem to be these two currents towards looking at what's and responding to what's beautiful, but also, I suppose, as you're saying, questioning what beauty really is. You know, can we say that, I suppose, ultimately, the idea of beauty is conditioned and empty like everything else, but, you know, on what level do we need to work on it as a kind of relative truth, if we want to use that language. Just to whether, you know, in the Dharma it is spoken of as things being ashubha, you know, that is a mark of conditioned things. And how does that sit alongside what we're talking about here?
Well, interestingly, actually, it's not a mark of conditioned things, because it's a viparyasa, not a lakshana. So, technically, what you're doing is it is that process of like seeing what has sort of expresses spiritual values, what's good and true and beautiful as beautiful, rather than what's expressing sort of baser values like craving and hatred as beautiful.
Mm-hmm. So can you say that again? What expresses spiritual
values? So basically, goodness and truth, and that's what's beautiful. So you're having to sort of, it's almost like you're retraining your mind, your responses, but actually it's also not unnatural, because I think in a way you're trying to, you're training your mind in a particular way, but actually also what you're doing is actually more fundamentally human in a particular way, because I think for all of us there is a response to what is of higher value, which is the Shraddha response. And that's what we're learning to tune into. It's almost like tuning into that.
Can I just clarify then? So if I'm standing in front of a beautiful, incredibly beautiful classical painting, so I look at it and my response to it is faith.
Yeah.
Then that would be something that I would want to cultivate. But if I stand in front of it and say, oh, I really want it, where can I buy a print?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, Bhante writes about this in Religion of Art, that if you respond, you know, that art can express those higher values.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
You know, so he talks about teaching poetry to the young men in Kalimpong and realising that he was teaching the Dharma, because they were expressive of higher values. But if we can also relate to them on the basis of craving, which would then mean, even though they were sort of expressing higher values, you're relating to them in craving. It's sort of, it's a whole theory in itself, because he talks about you've got to have the illumined imagination and the illumined image, if both come together. So if you respond to things on the basis of non-craving, and that thing in itself expresses higher values, then something really wonderful can happen.
Yeah.
You go into higher states of consciousness.
Yeah.
Now, this aesthetic reaction, you know, discussion around beauty, this to enable us to understand what balance effort is.
So in a way, this is the root kind of, the root subtle movement that's involved in balanced effort. Is you're aesthetically active. Balanced, perfect effort is being aesthetically active.
That's really helpful.
So that's at root what you're trying to do. It's not this kind of, I suppose what I'm saying is, it's not this like, make an effort. You know, it's not like that's what you're told when you're a kid, isn't it? Pull your socks up, get your finger out. Although sometimes, quite frankly,
but that's the thing, isn't it? That's the balance challenge for me. It's like, no, not that. But sometimes, yes, that.
Well, in a way, it's kind of a higher beauty.
Right, yeah. Like, if I can get to the mat, I know.
Yeah.
From the mat, for example.
Yeah.
I know I'm going to experience delight, or if I, you know, I can set things up. But sometimes the force for me is in getting there.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. But it's the balance that I find so tricky of when is it actually putting me off entirely and just making it me almost go... backwards, you know, and when is it?
Yeah.
You know, I can know that when I get there, it's exactly where I want to be. Anyway, that's
That's the struggle. I know what you mean.
Is it something to do with like the distance between here and there? Because it's like, if you've got like a goal that you're trying to get to, and you've got to push yourself to get there. For me, it's about making that distance less, so that there's something enjoyable a bit sooner. I've got to look at what it is that I'm going to do or how I'm going to do it, so that it's not just a slog for like a really long time. It's a little bit of a slog so that I can get some kind of appreciation from my practice, so the goal isn't too far away or something, so that kind of responsiveness comes in a bit sooner. So it's still a slog or a kind of like force, but it's less of a jump to something that I know I am going to appreciate, whatever that is in the practice. Like, it might look like meditating a bit differently, or it might look like wanting to talk to a friend instead of meditating. Yeah, rather than thinking I've got to go sit on my own in a shrine room somewhere for 40 minutes.
I think you've also got to look that if you're pushing yourself in that way for an extended period of time, it's not sustainable. So you've got to look at what's the underlying motivation and actually how to get more enjoyment in your spiritual life and whether, you know, the thing is the best thing to do. What I'm going to do is I'm going to hand out a handout. So, and we'll look at them in a little bit more detail. So just to say, I put a Pali in there, but I'm not a Pali scholar. So I might have got the grammar wrong, or I might have completely made a mess of it, but I don't even know. But, you know, the endings of the words might be a bit different.
Yeah, we wouldn't know.
Has everyone got one? Is there a double copy anywhere? So I thought what we'd do is we'd actually go into looking at what the Buddha said. So in a way, the right effort is therefore is the four right efforts traditionally in Buddhism. So let's go through it, because I think the Pali is interesting actually as well. It fleshes something out of it, and maybe some of you are familiar with some of the words. So perfect effort is, or right effort is Samavayama. Bhante translates Sama as perfect, not just right, as in right or wrong. It's more like, perfect. Vayama is as one would expect, striving, effort, exertion, endeavour. But what's interesting here, going back to what we were talking about before, is he says here monks generates desire, makes an effort, stirs up energy, exerts their mind, and strives to prevent the arising of unarisen evil, unwholesome mental states. They generate desire, make an effort, stir up energy, exert their mind, and strive to overcome evil, unwholesome mental states, to produce unarisen, wholesome mental states. And they generate desire, make an effort, stir up energy, exert their mind, and strive to maintain wholesome mental states that have arisen, not let them fade away, to bring them greater growth to the full perfection of development. This is called right effort. So I thought we'd just unpack that a little bit. So first of all, we've got awakened desire. So it's not that, you know, you've got to do something because someone else has told you it's right. It's not going to really motivate you in the long term. You've got to generate your own desire for that. Chanda. So has anyone heard the word chanda before?
Dharma chanda and karma chanda.
So what's the difference between dharma chanda and karma chanda?
Karma chanda is looking for sensual, ordinary pleasures. Dharma chanda is looking for pleasure in the Dharma thing.
Yeah.
In things that will help you to progress.
Yeah. So, yes, what you're looking for is So it's karma chanda as in senses, not not as in karma, as in action. So the Buddha said, in a way, the spiritual life is about kind of moving from that desire for sense experience to the desire for the Dharma. So it's quite, I don't know if this is the right expression, but anyway, it's quite fruity, isn't it, in words, desire. It's not like, I think it would be a really good idea. You know what I mean? It's sort of, it's more gutsy than that. It's a real desire for something. It's a desire for, as we were talking about, it's that kind of thing. It's a desire for the beautiful, in a sense. So how do we? Well, maybe we'll go. Maybe we'll go to that. I'll ask him in a minute. But so he generates desire, makes an effort. It stirs up energy. Has anyone heard that word before? Virya. What does virya mean?
Energy
in pursuit of the good. Vigorous initiatives and wholesome directions. You have a kind of bright line, can you? Vigorous initiative, like a wholesome direction.
Sounds like a food shop.
Yeah, exactly. A whole food shop corner. Yeah. Exerts. Look this up. To begin, start, undertake, attempt, make an effort or exert oneself. So I quite like that. If you get the whole kind of picture of it, it comes from a root which means to begin or start or to undertake or to attempt. It's like there's something in that that's a bit like, I'm going to give this a go. You know, I'm going to practice. Dharma Mai's got a thing, I'm staying in her room, she's got a thing above her piano that says something like, nothing remains difficult if practiced or something. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of spirit. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna give this a go. I'm gonna attempt it.
From the
Bodhicharya
Tara.
Ah, yes.
In the Miriam
section, I guess. Yeah. And strives. Interestingly, so strives comes from a root which means to stretch forth or hold out or take up. It can mean to stretch out the hollow hands in respectful greetings. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that means, stretching out, because it's not that, is it? It must be that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, could be receptivity. And it says to take up, to take care of, to favour, to support, to befriend. Put to exert, strain, apply vigorously one's mind. But befriending I quite like. I quite like that sort of respectful greeting and befriending. To prevent the arising of unarisen, unwholesome mental states, evil unwholesome. So we've got the Pali is papa, which means, we generally translate as evil. I think it's a complicated word in the English language, because it can imply basically a judging authority, but it's not got that connotation in Buddhism. There's no external judging authority. It's more really bad. Like, they're really unpleasant. Mm. Unwholesome. So what's unwholesome here, translation of?
Unskillful.
Unskillful. Mm. So what does unskillful suggest?
Things coming from greed, hatred or delusion.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. But what makes them unskillful? Why say unskillful? Because it's the word that's also used for if you're learning a craft.
Because it's a skill.
It's a skill.
That you have to practice.
Yeah, it's a skill that you have to practice. So it's not about kind of someone standing over you saying this is right, this is wrong. It's a skill. You're trying to shape yourself into enlightenment. You're trying to shape yourself into Bodhi. And some things are going to help you and some things aren't. Buddhism is extremely practical religion. You know, it's not about giving yourself a hard time. It's like, okay, it's like the Panti talks about yourself, your own work of art. So if you're your own work of art, you're trying to create yourself into something of beauty. You need the right tools. You need to put the paint in the right place or the chisel in the right place. You know, you're creating yourself, basically.
I think when you're talking about creating yourself and making yourself, I think one of the things is it's very individual. We're not all going to need the same skillful means or what have you to create that poetry.
Yeah.
So I can't say to somebody else, well, you need to do that because that might not apply to them. So it's very much, if you like, individualistic as how you do create that poetry rather than sort of following. You can't follow the crowd if you like.
So how do we discern in our experience, given that we've all got individual minds and what we need to do, how do we distinguish in our experience what is skillful, what are unwholesome and what are wholesome states of mind? Interesting, just before we look at that, actually, Dharma, mental states of Dharma, which I think is interesting because basically they're saying phenomena of mind. So what does phenomena of mind mean, really? What they're phenomena? What does that suggest?
That suggests kind of the Dhaka to me. The fruits is what you get up to.
So it's karma of the Dhaka. I mean, it suggests to me also that they're not particularly personal. Mm-hmm. It's not like my greed and my hatred that defines me. It's just like, it's as you say, it's like certain actions lead to certain states of mind.
Yeah.
Certain states of mind lead to certain
actions. Arising upon conditions.
They're just arising. They're phenomena of mind that arise dependent on condition. They're universal. It's not you've got your own special mental states, unfortunately. I'm sorry to say. But, you know, you're not your own unique person with my own crazy mind. And everyone else is fine. It's a bit like they're just phenomena of mind. They've got lists of them. It's called the Abhidharma. You know, it's not you or yours particularly. You haven't actually got any states of mind that's original.
I can't quite remember trying to retain it. What you said before this, but what arose for me was it's something about like positive impulse, you know, what's that thing where people say, you know, when you have an impulse, a desire to do something that's positive, generosity or compassion or whatever, to follow through with that, and even if you don't get the chance to follow through with that, the actual thought or whatever is more positive than the negative aspect of being grumpy or not wanting to do it or having bad feeling around. Does that make sense? So it's what you said about something about being, how can you do that? It's that, that sort of moving towards.
Yeah, so you're moving towards your delight and you're following through.
But it's not as though you actually had thought, oh, I'm going to do that, it just comes.
Yeah. So it's a response. What's beautiful. So how do we find in our experience what is the distinction between skillful and unskillful states of mind? So we can give you the list, but how do you distinguish it in your experience?
Watching it all play out. I like the idea of skillful in terms of almost an intelligence, and not like a bookish, like, I think it looks intelligent, but I've really watched
like, open my mind over a number of years, and I know that if I act, if my mind is stated one anger, nothing good is going to come of that, and everything is like bad consequences. Like, I know that in my gut, because I've seen it happen enough times.
So, but then in your experience, like, how do you know what you don't want to play out and what you do? What? How do you distinguish in your own consciousness what is skillful and what is unskillful?
I think the unskillful feels like it's much more contracted and hard, whereas if it's a skillful response, it tends to be very open and connecting.
I think that's what I was trying to say, that it's a moving towards. When I start pushing things away, I know that that's
not skillful. Yeah, okay, so skillful is opening out, is connecting, it's moving towards, whereas unskillful is you're contracted.
Except we can move towards with greed.
Okay, so in that moment of greed, how do you know it's greed?
It's still closing down.
So how do you know you're closing down?
I think it's almost it's a felt quality in my opinion. It's almost it's a set of bodily sensations. You know, I can feel when I'm experiencing, you know, very much like you were saying, is that feeling of physical contraction, my mind is tight and agitated. It makes me think of that analogy of holding a bird. It's like I can feel my mind squeezing and
when you're grasping and don't get it, then you know.
It doesn't always have to be translated into action, but often it does. But it's just like a film. It's a set of sensations, and often that is a really good guide as to whether or not something I want to pursue.
Which is back to aesthetic, isn't it? Because it's what feels beautiful, what you know, contracted death feels beautiful, does it? It always feels ugly and tight.
And there's a kind of, like, even with craving, so you're sort of moving towards something, but what I notice is that also my mind is also blocking out something else. Do you see what I mean? So it's like if you're craving, even on a subtle level about food, you know, so I'm quite greedy actually, I do realise this, but there's some delicious food that someone's brought for lunch. I look at it and then it's a bit like I'm looking and thinking, oh, there's only one piece of that left. And then it's like then I'm closing down my awareness of other people because I'm going with that.
Prioritising yourself over others.
You're prioritising yourself over others. You're prioritising that thing over everything else. You know, we get that with people as well, don't we? You know, you're pushing away the rest because you want that thing and you want it for yourself and you want it to be a particular way as well. Yeah, and I think what that does with me is it's quite fixing, it's quite impulsive. So then I'm not taking a broader awareness of the picture. I just want that thing to happen, you know. Like I want to talk to that person. And then it leads me to be a bit impulsive and not really aware of what's happening.
There's a lot of energy in that as well. You can feel it like a dry, you know, that kind of... it can be quite subtle, but it also can be very full of energy. That cake's got my name on it.
Or that person's got my name on it. That's what's so horrendous,
isn't
it? They're mine.
Or that seat on the bus.
This kind of maps onto my experience in meditation as well. Often, like, one of the signs I pick up on earliest that I'm drifting into the hindrances is I experience this kind of physical sensation of mental tightening. And that often that's a really effective way for me to move away. No, I'm in the territory of the hindrances and try to move away from it. It's just to physically, I know that sounds really weird, to relax the mind.
Yeah.
And you say that to beginners, it's like, well, what is that? Relax the mind. But with experience, it is something I feel I can do. I can almost like physically relax my mind.
I know exactly what you mean, because there is something about relaxing the mind, which is what I do is I sometimes do a visualization almost of
there's my consciousness has this limit, and trying to relax beyond that limit to just encompass everything. And it does feel like relaxing your mind, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
It's how I kind of cope when I can feel myself getting a bit tight and a bit over focused or something. It's just relaxing the mind out to encompass everything. It's also incidentally how I sleep in India. Instead of, because I realised what was happening was very noisy, and then I'd feel myself kind of contracting to kind of give myself a little safe space. And then I thought, well, why don't you just do the opposite? And just allow the mind to open out and encompass everything, so everything is part of you. And that's what I do when I'm just tense, generally, actually, in meditation or whatever. It's just like, well, how can I open out my mind to encompass the whole experience rather than trying to keep it safe within this little band of experience.
And then everything is mine.
And then everything is mine.
That's great.
Well, our mental state's always reflected in some way in our somatic experience, aren't they? And I think, you know, I kind of come to realise that you can, it works the opposite way around as well. By kind of paying attention to your body, you can also then affect and diffuse particular mental states. And I find it really useful paying attention to how particular mental states, negative and positive, kind of manifest in my posture or that sense of tightness or, you know, there's a really, I suppose one of the things in Western culture is, you know, we separate mind and body, don't we? Whereas I suppose, you know, actually through meditation we see that they're really very closely linked.
So that's what aesthetically active is. You're learning to see, well, what characterizes skillful and unskillful states of mind on that basic aesthetic level of, like, it's a contracted, my body contracts, we hold tension in a particular way in our bodies, or am I open and expansive and a sort of, there's a kind of vibrancy of quality of the mind. It's sort of energetic and bright consciousness. And how do we delight in that? Because that's the other thing. It's asking us to delight and desire wholesome mental states and the abandoning of unskillful mental states. So how do we delight in these things, you know, in delight in cultivating positive mental states and delight in, it's actually taking, you know, desire to eradicate unskillful mental states.
I guess some of it is from experience, isn't it? If we can apply our knowledge of how we feel when we're wrapped up in an unskillful mental state, and if we've got experience of a skillful mental state, then we're naturally going to want to move towards that.
Yeah, so it's like Leela Matthew was saying, you sort of, you see the bigger picture, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, it's the whole, like, this is what happens. I mean, one can also sort of experience some sort of revulsion or horror of unskillful mental state.
Yeah.
It's really interesting, actually. I was talking to someone about death. And I was saying, actually, there's something I'm more frightened of than death, and that's unskillful mental states. And doing something really unethical.
You know what the cost of it is.
Yeah, you know what the cost of it is.
Also, you can take pleasure in the physical experience.
Yeah.
It's the link between the physical and mental experience.
Yeah, of the skillful.
Yeah, you can. And outside of meditation, you know, just take pleasure in how it actually feels.
And then take displeasure. So there's pleasure that is associated with higher states of consciousness. You know, the pleasures of the path, basically. And pleasure in the skillful, which can be extremely physically felt. So it's learning also to notice that. You know, that feeling that you get when you are generous, or the feeling that you get when you cultivate love and openness towards others. when you're kind, or when you see kindness.
Something about where you choose to place your attention as well. The book recently where I was just saying, it was unbelievably unwise to dwell too much on the negative mental states. What we should really be focusing on is cultivating the positive mental state. And I just sort of noticed something in myself and my attitude to the Dharma in my life. And I can get very fixated on trying to fix the one thing that is unpleasant or unskillful in my experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking, like, maybe I could just change my attention away from that to what is pleasurable or pleasant or expansive or skillful.
Yeah, it's kind of like what you were saying before about we can get very caught up in my grief or my suffering, my terrible whatever time that I'm having. Just taking the attention away from that.
There's something to be said for, you know, when you're in a negative mental space, actually looking beyond what you're actually desiring or what your instincts are telling you to do as a response to that. What hurts? What's the back in me? And just a little bit of self-meta, self-care. Instead of taking it out on, you know, finding out that you're taking it out on other people.
So that, in a way, brings us through, because the four right efforts are basically, and you've got them here, the first is preventing unarisen, unskillful states of mind from developing. The second is eradicating unskillful states of minds that have arisen. The third is cultivating unarisen skillful states of mind. And the fourth is maintaining arisen skillful states of mind. So it's preventing, eradicating, cultivating, maintaining. So I'm just going to say something briefly about all of these, actually, and then so that we've got our, because we've got a question about how we practice in each of these four areas. So preventing is basically, in a way, all of these require one to know oneself. So you've got to take a really honest look at your mind and your mental states. And the first one is preventing. So it's looking at knowing what puts us in a bad state. What I quite like is that in Myers-Briggs, they talk about being in the grip and how we all experience being in the grip of negative, basically unskillful states of mind. Being in the grip looks like different things for everyone. And it's knowing what gets you into the grip. That's when you've kind of really gone into something very habitual. So I just go completely, my emotions just go, I can think very clearly. And it's like something switches in my brain and I become a complete emotional mess. It's quite shocking to see. And then I go into this total crisis of confidence and, you know, just feeling like a worthless human being, you know. So I know that at that point I've got in the grip of something. But how did I get there? What are the conditions? So even if it's not that extreme, even if it's just like what puts me in a negative mental state. So, you know, certain films, does it really help? If I just sort of surf the internet all night or go to bed very late, that's my initial thing. Or listen to particular types of music or watch particular types of films or programs. You know, often what gets me into negative states of mind is not having enough sleep. Very, very basic thing. You know, being with even certain people can be quite demanding. So what you do is you know what gets you into unskillful states of mind, and you set up conditions to stop them happening. So this is how you're working with the teacher at Samapada. I know that if I go to bed really late, habitually, and before I'm going to bed I'm just like looking at rubbish on the internet, I'm going to wake up in a bit of a bad mood. So what is sometimes called in mind training is called the force of destruction. You'll probably look at this in the urban retreat next week. But It's a force of destruction in that you anticipate what's going to put you in an unskillful state of mind and you just don't do it.
Mm. And you don't do it because the habit is so strong.
Mm.
And somehow it's feeding something.
Mm.
It's giving you something that you think is a good thing.
Yeah.
So it's just like, oh.
But that's why you start to see it as sort of ugly.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where this
movement is. That's the lovely is unlovely thing.
Yeah, you're thinking it's lovely. You're thinking it's sort of beautiful to watch rubbish in the internet.
This is helping me in some way, I'm thinking. Yes. I mean,
so, okay, so I'm looking at clips of Twilight. That's I'm really embarrassed about that.
Oh.
Anyway, so if I look at clips of Twilight, then I think, like, that's going to feed me or be beautiful in some way.
Yeah.
It's really not. It's just really, really not going to do that. So I've got to almost sort of seeing actually, in a way, that's closing down of my being and not wanting to get into that state. Mm.
So it's what do I actually need, isn't it? Or feed that need that's not negative.
Yeah.
Mm. It's I think discipline, you know, is a kind of a much maligned word.
Mm.
But the kind of... If we're talking about four right efforts, what comes to my mind is discipline.
Yeah.
And it's discipline for me is the thing that gets me to do the thing that I know is really good for me, you know, and for the benefit of all beings, not just me. And identify what that looks like in my life.
Yeah.
And doing that.
Yeah. Well, Bhante talks about it quite simply. He says, basically, who are you inviting into your home? Who are you entertaining? What are you entertaining? Actually, you know there's a Rumi poem about the guest house.
The guest house.
Well, actually, I have to say that the Buddha got there first. He has also got a little poem on the guest house about watching what's coming into your mind. You know, and who are you inviting? You know, what are you doing with that? You know, and who are you inviting in?
I remember Alan Matthew saying that everything that you put in leaves an impact on the mind.
Yeah.
Everything you're watching, listening.
Yeah.
You know, so you're just like stirring up habitual sort of patterns by doing that.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes they come back to you when you least expect them to.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
A bit like Joe Simpson, he had that thing where he was he thought he was going to die. Do you remember it? Or he thought he'd think something.
What?
He thought he was going to die.
Touching the bottom.
He didn't die, but he basically was going to die, and he thought he'd better think something profound. But actually, what went round his head was this earworm of Brown Girl in the Ring. It's actually, what a terrible song.
Can I just say, just in terms of like real practical conditions, I went on some medical training recently and learned something really useful, which was. It's called halt.
Yeah.
Are you hungry, angry, late, or tired?
Mm.
In which case, you know, you're probably going to have a really bad consultation with this next page.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like hungry, angry,
late,
or tired.
Yeah, and those are the conditions.
Halt.
Yeah.
You're going to have a bad time.
Yeah.
And I just found it really useful.
It's lovely, isn't it? Mm. I've come across that as well in terms of... working with depression and working with people, and say, okay, before you, so trying to prevent people from spiraling or globalizing, and just, okay, here's a checklist.
Yeah.
Attend to these things first, it's the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, then. Are you still in that place? Yeah.
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 I think.
Okay.
With those tendencies that I have, maybe to watch things that aren't that helpful, or to invite people into my home that I don't really want there. Actually, I'm really used to them being there, so if I'm doing what I can to for them not to be there anymore, or to not watch those clips anymore, it's quite uncomfortable, because that change is like, I'm actually starting to feel really well, and confident, and sleeping really well, and... So I think, for me, kindness that I've got into a habitual way of being that is unhelpful or constricted, and I'm so used to that, like the tale of the woman with the fish basket, is really important, so that I'm not just kind of like trying to shove a part of myself away that I'm actually really, really comfortable with, but I'm really, it's unskillful and unhelpful. It's like I need to kind of like bless that out of my life in a way.
I do think it is important, and I think that's why, you know, going back to, it's also important to cultivate the positive, and sometimes when you cultivate the positive, which we'll go into, in a way the others slightly take care of themselves. So this is just looking at very, very kind of practical thing, and as a sort of aesthetic thing of not I should do this because I'm a good Buddhist, even, or I've got to push it out of my mind or push this out. But it's more like a sense of, actually, I just don't want to do this anymore. So the other one is eradicating. So arisen negative mental states, when you are in the grip of them, is understanding this is what this is and having a sense of, I'm in the grip of something and this is painful and constricting. And there's various ways that one could look at, you know, I'm sure you've looked at how to sort of remove the hindrances as they arise. I was thinking actually in a way, for me, it comes back to two aspects actually, really. One of them is faith. I think if I'm really going to eradicate negative mental states of arise that arisen, it's a bit like I have to have a view of myself as more than this. And maybe this is where your compassion aspect comes in. It's a bit like, okay, I'm in this state, but it's not me or mine.
Take it personally.
Yeah, and actually there is a possibility of me not being in this state. It's not defining me or limiting me. And it's not the whole of me. It's not my being. It's arisen on dependence on conditions. And when those conditions cease, that mental state will cease. So also looking at, sometimes you can look into their very nature, look into the very nature of these things, which is empty. You know, it's not me or mine. It's risen on dependence on conditions. It's not something real or tangible. You can't build a wall out of it. It's a state of mind. Comes and goes. And with that, you can also practice sky-like mind. So I think that's where it's a bit like kind of clouds forming in the mind and passing away. So not fixing on them, not seeing them as real or ultimate. But these arise in dependence on conditions. And they're what people experience. I think a lot, it's not just compassion for myself that I feel, but also kind of connecting to this is the state of humanity. There's a wonderful piece in the Parinibbana Sutta where the Buddha says to the monks, he says, it's through not understanding, through not penetrating the Four Noble Truths, have we run on and wandered round this, run round and wandered on this long, long journey, both you and I. Mm. Well, what a tender thing to say. You know, the Buddha was enlightened. He was Samyak Sambuddha. But he said, you know, we have wandered on this long journey, both you and I. And this is samsara, the arising of negative, painful, destructive mental states that do not lead to our own welfare, and they do not lead to the welfare of others, and they're painful to experience, and they keep us away from enlightenment. And what a pity. Both you and I. We're just deluded. So I think a lot of the eradicating those negative mental states that have arisen is just recognizing them for what they are, almost as an aesthetic quality, and seeing through to their very nature. And then we get to cultivating, because of course then it's very important to set up the conditions for cultivating positive states of mind. And knowing what gets us into a good state, I mean, my New Year's resolution actually this year, which we did in the puja on New Year's Eve, was to nourish the roots of good.
Nice.
I quite like that little phrase. Nourish the roots of good. Yeah. Give me royalties later. So thinking of ourselves at our best, and what are the conditions that really help us to become our best? What are the conditions that give rise to positive states, skillful states of mind?
Having
our
mental health.
Yeah.
Being around spiritual
practice and spiritual communities. Yeah, yeah. You know, when have you been happiest? That's another question you can ask yourself. When is it you've been happiest? And also, having to cultivate positive states of mind, really putting ourselves in relationship to what's best in ourselves, and even what's best beyond best in ourselves, but what's best in the universe. You know, what's putting ourselves in relationship to what is truly beautiful, and to put ourselves into conditions where that arises. So we'll talk about these, you know, in after lunch. Actually, I came across this quote of Hunty's actually the other day when I was mindlessly surfing through Facebook. This is not always bad. I saw a quote of Hunty saying, "A successful Dharma life requires imaginative connection with the goal, some definite sense of reality beyond self-clinging. If there is no such connection and sense, then spiritual life becomes no more than a refinement of self-identity at best." So basically, I think what he's saying is that actually part of cultivating skillful states of mind and faith is to put ourselves in relationship to our own potential Buddhahood or Buddhahood itself. You know, that's just something to think about. It's not just about putting yourself in a positive state of mind in terms of happiness. It's also putting yourself in a having that response to what is ultimate in the universe. And the other one is maintaining. So, you know, we know that our mental states come and go, and it's very easy to slip back. So part of it is about maintaining positive states of mind that have arisen. And I think largely that's about our lifestyle, a lifestyle that encourages and maintains skillful states of mind. It's a bit like that feeling, you know, you go on retreat, perhaps you go on your retreat for the first time, and you experience much more expansive states of mind, and it's quite wonderful, and then you get that kind of terrible feeling of going back, and then you realise that you've got to set up your life in a way that's supportive to those skillful states of mind, so that you can continue those skillful states of mind. And you start making lifestyle changes. And it's interesting because lifestyle changes that people make when they're Buddhists come out of that sense. They don't come out of someone telling you, you've got to do it like this. They've got to come out of a sense of you experiencing yourself in a more skillful state of mind and then setting up conditions that allow that to continue. Building a life that supports your aspirations. So those are the four right efforts. It's an aesthetically active practice of learning to respond to the beautiful in one's own mind, to what's beautiful and skillful in our mental states, and learning to, in a way, shrink away, not in a cutting off or repressing, but in the sense of learning to cultivate skillful states of mind and prevent and eradicate unskillful states of mind, and to do that in a way that's balanced and a response to beauty rather than a willed, forceful effort.